In for Robin Young. It's here and now. Is NASA allowing its astronauts to fly drunk? A NASA report released today cites at least two occasions where NASA gave astronauts the okay to fly, even after flight surgeons and other astronauts warned that crew members were too drunk to fly. Astronauts were also accused of breaking the bottle-to-throttle rule that prohibits drinking alcohol within 12 hours of takeoff. The report also cited low morale among medical personnel who said their opinions regarding flight readiness were disregarded. The investigation into health and psychological screening at NASA came after the arrest of Lisa Nowak, that astronaut who allegedly attacked a romantic rival in a bizarre love triangle with another astronaut. NASA says allegations of astronauts flying drunk came from anonymous sources. Frank Mooring of Aviation Week and Space Technology broke the story on possible drinking in space. We spoke to him earlier about the allegations.
In my reporting, I found that while at least at the moment, they're anonymous, both in terms of who made the allegations and who the allegations were about. They were from multiple sources and consistent. There were at least two, maybe more, incidents in which astronauts flew while, in the opinion of their colleagues, both flight surgeons and other astronauts, they were impaired.
A tight group of people, perhaps it's not surprising that people might not want to come forward and make direct allegations.
That, I think, is the bigger story here. The allegations were made to a panel of outside medical experts, mostly government flight surgeons and psychiatrists, who were convened to review astronaut health monitoring in the wake of the Lisa Nowak arrest back in February. The question was whether there was something that they should have picked up on in her case. The report basically is going to say that NASA doesn't really monitor the health of its astronauts as closely as we thought they did, and certainly not the behavioral health. The drinking is an extreme example of that.
Well, the idea that they would let them fly under those circumstances is pretty shocking.
It's incomprehensible.
Bill Gerstenmaier, a NASA manager, said he had never seen an intoxicated astronaut before a flight. But another former NASA executive told Associated Press that some astronauts are former test and fight pilots who are a, quote, pretty hard-living bunch, unquote, and just the idea of this bottle-to-throttle rule suggests something. Could you describe the lifestyle of NASA astronauts?
You know, to me, it seems like it's kind of a suburban lifestyle. They live in the suburbs of Houston. They, you know, they go to cookouts. They work real hard. They travel a lot. Mm. I personally have no experience of astronauts partying hard. I do know that military pilots, and I'll have to say I would be really, really surprised if these individuals were military pilots because of the work that they have to do when the shuttle is launching. But military pilots have a philosophy of, there's no reason to talk to a flight surgeon because all they can do is ground you. So things like this are kind of, health problems, maybe behavioral problems, maybe drinking problems, might tend to get swept under the rug a little bit.
I don't mean to appear naive here, but how dangerous would it be for an astronaut to fly drunk?
Probably on a nominal flight, the biggest danger would be to the astronaut, him or herself. Some kind of extreme physiological response to the G-loads and everything else, the vibrations. A number of the people on the shuttle during liftoff are essentially passengers. Their work starts as soon as they get to space. And the danger to them would be, and to maybe to their colleagues, would be if there was a problem, if they had to do an emergency evacuation from the pad, which involves moving fast and doing some fairly scary things.
This has been an embarrassing year from NASA in terms of its public relations. I don't think anyone in the country doesn't know the story of the astronaut in diapers after Lisa Nowak was arrested and charged with attempted kidnapping and more in connection with that alleged love triangle with another astronaut. How damaging is this report to NASA?
Certainly it's embarrassing. There's been a lot of interest in this story. I am really hopeful that it's a good thing in that it will cause the agency to address the problems that I believe that will be raised in the report by this panel of government physicians and the separate report that was done at Johnson Space Center where the astronauts operate.
So far, bad news comes in pairs today. The other story is the report that an employee for a NASA subcontractor sabotaged wires in a computer. NASA found out a week and a half ago and says it would have found the mistake before takeoff. But what do reports like that and the other one due to NASA's credibility?
I think the drinking report and the astronaut health screening report is a systemic issue. It sounds like the sabotage issue was an isolated incident involving one person at a subcontractor.
Do you think the story could in any way derail the launch of the Endeavour, which is scheduled for August 7th?
Well, the question came up at the Flight Readiness Review briefing yesterday, and the answer was no. You know, they're going to fly.
Frank Mooring of Aviation Week and Space Technology. Thanks for joining us, Frank.
Thank you.
There are two tragedies of being crazy in America, as author Mary Beth Pfeiffer writes in her book of the same name. The first tragedy is the actual condition of being mentally ill. The second is what happens to someone who is diagnosed as mentally ill and winds up in jail or prison. 1 in 7 inmates in America's prisons is mentally ill. That's 330,000 people. And on average, those inmates spend a long time in solitary confinement, where their condition is made worse, claims Pfeiffer. In her new book, Crazy in America, the hidden tragedy of our criminalized mentally ill, Mary Beth Pfeiffer documents the stories of 6 mentally ill people who were shunted to the farthest edge of prison society. She joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, David.
You've chosen case studies as the best way of telling what can happen to someone who's mentally ill once they get into the jail or prison system. And I know to our listeners that these stories are graphic and disturbing. Begin by telling us about a woman named Shane Egan from Iowa.
Shane represents certainly something typical of what happens to people with mental illness. And Shane was 14 when she was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Over the next couple of decades, Shane was in and out of the mental health system, in and out of hospitals 25 times. She was very seriously ill, often would break down and have delusions and believe that she was, for example, on vision quests performed by Native Americans. She would jump out of trees, attack dogs. These are the types of things that people with mental illness will sometimes do when they are ill. And it was about when she was in her early 30s that Shane again became ill, and she jumped through a window and the police were called. And the police officer meant all well and good in trying to subdue Shane. And Shane's response was to take a knife and to suddenly lunge toward him, and she stabbed him in the shoulder. And although Shane, for all intents and purposes, was insane at the time of her crime and should have been adjudicated as someone not guilty by reason of insanity, she, like many people who have mental illness and become involved with the criminal justice system, went to prison, and it was all downhill from there.
So prison is bad enough, but Shane's put in solitary confinement when she gets to prison, which is considered a form of punishment and control for people who are mentally healthy. How much worse for Shane?
Well, Shane, like many people, had trouble conforming with prison rules. And what happens with people who are mentally ill, who will talk out of line, who will not follow directions, many of them are put into solitary confinement units. And I've had experts in mental health care tell me that you can judge the quality of a prison system's mental health care by the solitary confinement unit, because these, for all intents and purposes and all across America, have become insane asylums, Victorian-era almost insane asylums in America.
So let's introduce some statistics here, if we may, Mary Beth. Do mentally ill inmates spend more time in solitary than normal inmates?
Well, definitely. You'll find a much higher proportion of people with mental illness in the solitary confinement units. You'll also find a much larger share of prison suicides occurring there because the conditions are so terribly stressful. Basically, 4 walls, a solid steel door, a small window, and little, if any, diversion in terms of no television, no radio, very little reading material, and your food is delivered to you through a little slot in the door. That's your sole human contact. And these are the kinds of conditions that are damaging to people who are sane. You can imagine what they will do to someone who is schizophrenic or who suffers from bipolar disorder or other serious mental illnesses.
And this is a situation Shane finds herself in. She's in solitary confinement. Can you read for us part of the letter that Shane wrote to her aunt, Pat? She's serving a 4-month stint in solitary, and it starts with Shane writing, "I'm in the hole," the hole being what inmates call solitary confinement.
Sure. "I am still in the hole. I spoke to the prison psychologist last week. She doesn't think it is healthy for me to be in here this long. She said she was going to say something, but I think she forgot. I don't really get a lot of attention in here. Day after day, hour after hour, I sit in here alone. I don't usually talk much anyway, but it would be nice if someone would stop by my door. People just don't seem to have time for me. Being alone is torment.
You write that eventually Shane breaks down and begins a spiral into behavior that can only be described as self-destructive.
She was so deprived of human contact that she and many other people in other facilities of this kind will take to mutilating themselves. Sometimes they'll do it to get out of the unit. Sometimes they'll do it for attention. Sometimes they'll do it because they're so angry or they've just completely lost connection with reality. I've seen photographs of inmates who have gouged huge gouges up and down their legs. I've read medical reports of inmates who have swallowed things. They'll swallow pieces of metal or pieces of their eyeglasses.
She did something even more extreme.
Yes. Shane's story is just very dramatic and very sad. And she gouged out both of her eyes while she was in prison, while she was behind bars, and while she was in solitary confinement. And the, I guess, extreme irony of this is that she was medically fixed up. She went to a hospital. She was treated for these injuries. And then she was put back into solitary confinement where she continued to mutilate herself. And really, it wasn't until her story made the papers that the state of Iowa began to respond to this and to start to provide better care for people with mental illness who are in their facilities.
She finally got out of prison. She headed off to central Iowa to find that tribe of Indians that she mistakenly believes she belongs to.
She was released to her own devices, given a month's worth of medication, a $100 check, and let go to this freedom that she desperately craved. And after 4 days of partying and spending down her money, she was finally returned to her home community. It took about 6 weeks before Shane ended up back in the criminal justice system. She set a fire that caused $400,000 worth of damage.
Oof.
She stabbed her boyfriend. But this is what happens to people who are mentally ill, who are left to their own devices in our communities of today.
Is there some hope for her today?
There is hope. The second time that she was released from prison, there was a plan for her care. Instead of being sent off to the streets, given a $100 check and a small supply of medication, she went to a mental hospital where she has been cared for since. And I have hope for her because of who Shane is. She is, regardless or despite what has happened to her, a very happy person with a great outlook toward life and a great joy in living. And I think that she will land on her feet in terms of her future. If she gets the care that she needs, she will.
We're speaking with Mary Beth Pfeiffer, who writes about the mentally ill in prison. About 15% of the prison population in the U.S. has mental illness. When we come back, the connection between prisons, the mentally ill, and drug use. That's when we return, Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She's a journalist who for the last 6 years has been writing extensively about the mentally ill and how they fare in our prison systems. Her new book, Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of Our Criminalized Mentally Ill, emerged from reporting she did for a New York Times magazine piece called A Death in the box being the special housing units, the solitary confinement chambers, where she found that rates of suicide for the mentally ill dramatically higher than for the general prison population. And Mary Beth, you write that half of all incarcerated juveniles who committed suicide in the late 1990s were housed in isolation at the time of their deaths.
Yes, isolation is well known to be a predisposing factor towards suicide. And nonetheless, in California and in many other states, you will find young people, 14, 15, 16 years old, in solitary confinement.
You also write about Luke Ashley. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, ended up in jail for possession of 2 pills of ecstasy, also hung himself in jail. You make the point that a number of the mentally ill go to jail because of substance abuse, and yet while confined, the prison system tries to deal with them by prescribing heavy drugs to control them. Are you saying these drugs are inappropriate?
Well, Luke developed bipolar disorder when he was about 19 or 20, and as many people with mental illness will do, he began to self-medicate. He smoked copious amounts of marijuana. He took ecstasy regularly, and he was arrested finally for having two pills of ecstasy, and he was put onto probation. And the hurdles that Luke had to climb, even being on probation, were just momentous for someone who was dealing with a significant mental illness. He had 4 years of probation, so he had to stay clean and off drugs for that period of time. He had $3,000 in fines. He had to go to NA and AA meetings. He had to do community service. These were all just momentous hurdles for him to clear. And as people with mental illness who self-medicate will do, he fell off the wagon. And so he was sent to jail with the idea that he would wait there until a substance abuse bed opened up. The system expected this bed to open up not in a week, not in 2 weeks, but in 4 months. And Luke simply could not cope behind bars. He lasted at the Williamson County Jail for 10 days before he committed suicide. And on the night of his death, he spoke to his mother 3 times.
And in your book, you provide transcripts of those conversations. Can you read one of them for us? I'm looking at page 82.
All right. This is the last of Luke's conversation home with his mother on the night that he died. "Mom, you used to be this person that never gave up, that never backed down and shit like that. You need to call somebody and talk to them and make them believe me. Now you act like there's just no hope. I still have faith in you. I still have faith that you can help me, but you don't. I can't even see straight right now, Mom. Everything is like a fisheye lens. My distortions are so bad that I don't even know what's going on. Tricia, like I said, honey. Luke, I feel like I'm on acid, but nothing is wrong with me. I'm just BSing the lady, and there's nothing wrong with that? That's what I need you to help me with."
You talk about large institutions and the institutions being jails and prisons. There seems to be a certain irony here because, of course, many people were in institutions for the mentally ill before people with your sensitivities and critics of those systems as being callous or medieval wanted them closed and pushed deinstitutionalization. So you have this deinstitutionalization. It puts people on the streets, and many of these people have gotten into the problems that have put them back.
Yes, exactly. Deinstitutionalization was not in itself a bad thing. We housed people in large hospitals, and we kept people there for far too long. They would often live out their lives there or spend years in hospitals. So when we opted to deinstitutionalize, as it's called, it was an outgrowth of a more enlightened view that people with mental illness could be managed in communities, that we had drugs that had developed over the years, Thorazine being the first one in 1953, that could manage people in communities. But we failed to provide the other basics that are necessary for people with mental illness in communities.
Well, you finished the painting here. It's a devastating picture of a criminal system that criminalizes sick people, makes criminals and inmates sicker, and misdiagnoses people who may not be sick at all. In brief, what's the proposal?
Well, the first thing on my top 10 list of things we need to do to help people with mental illness, we have to stop building prisons. Prisons and jails have sapped so much money in this country. We spend about $60 billion a year to support them. And if we just diverted some of that money to these programs that I discussed, and also, if we trained police officers and correction officers in dealing with people with mental illness with whom they come in contact, I think we could go a long way toward dealing with the problem.
That may not happen anytime soon, as you, I'm sure, are well aware. Talk about the procedures, though, of solitary and what you propose regarding solitary that might lessen the problem.
My primary prescription is don't send people with mental illness into prisons. But secondarily, if they're going to go to prison, and there are 330,000 there today at least, we have to provide the care that they need. And for the most part, inmates with mental illness are in the general population. They are victimized, they act out, they end up in solitary confinement units where they just get worse, their behavior deteriorates, and they break down. Some prisons around the country are providing specialized units for people with mental illness. They'll provide counseling. They'll be overseen by correction officers with training that allows them, when they see someone who's acting out in a way that reflects mental illness, not to exacerbate the situation, but to bring it under control.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer, author of Crazy in America. Thanks for joining us today, Mary Beth.
Thanks for having me, David.
A couple of stories we're working on for next week on Here and Now. Military planners are looking back at the end of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. Are there any lessons that can be learned when the U.S. pulls out of Iraq? Also, none of the above. If it was on a ballot, would you be tempted to check that box? That's Here and Now. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. When is chocolate chocolate? When's maple syrup, and mayonnaise, mayonnaise? Important questions connected to a petition by a dozen food industry groups who want more freedom to change the recipes for making those products and others. Joining us first is Robert Earle. He's Senior Director for Nutrition Policy at the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which filed a citizen's petition with the Food and Drug Administration. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The grocery manufacturers have been joined by snack makers, chocolate manufacturers, even the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. What's behind the petition?
Well, behind the petition is to continue to have standards that provide a level of fairness for consumers, but also to provide flexibility with changing technology and information about ingredients and nutrition so that consumers can benefit not only from economic fairness, but also potentially to improve and benefit their health and wellness.
So you want to make both additions where new technology comes into play that you argue make the food have a longer shelf life, be safer, store better, that sort of thing. But you're also looking for the ability to substitute.
Yes, the ability to substitute, to look at different ingredients that can improve or keep pace with technology and imparting greater quality to the consumer, as well as being able to make nutrition changes that are suitable and appropriate that can benefit diet and health.
So there is the issue of substitution. And in the case of chocolate making, it's been stated that confectioners have petitioned the FDA to be able to replace cocoa butter with cheaper fats and still call the resulting product chocolate. Is that true?
Well, that is not something that is articulated in the petition at all. The petition would apply to the standard for chocolate, and that's one of the over 260 food standards at the Food and Drug Administration, but there is not a specific request to change the chocolate standard of identity contained in this petition.
The idea of substitution raises an issue: how much maple syrup should be in maple syrup before you're required to change the name? And when it comes to chocolate, how much cocoa butter can you replace and still call the product chocolate? Isn't this going to be the big problem with consumers or activists?
Related to chocolate specifically, I don't think that's going to be the case, because consumers are demanding premium chocolate with high cocoa content, and those products will still always be made according to what consumers desire. And I think to suggest otherwise would be misleading.
But the question is, of course, would the other products still be allowed to be called chocolate? I mean, the French, as you know, call chocolate with substitutions another and unflattering name. Doesn't that come down to it when you're talking about identities?
As you mentioned, the case in Europe, Europe does allow up to 5% alternative fats beyond cocoa butter in its chocolate products already, and that can help in maintaining quality and look over time for temperatures and those types of things. But this could allow flexibility, and there may be some ingredients that may have the same type of properties and perhaps different health profiles.
As a grocery manufacturers association, you must be keenly aware of the concerns consumers have about the quality of food and the ingredients in food. Wouldn't clearer standards of identity increase consumer confidence?
Our petition would not make standards less clear at all, but it would allow things that, for example, pineapple juice as new agents that prevent foaming to come on the market to be allowed. In the case of chocolate, this flexibility would allow for clear and level playing field for the development of sugar-free chocolate products called chocolate that could benefit consumers with diabetes.
Robert Earle, Senior Director for Nutrition Policy at the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which filed the citizens' petition with the FDA. Thanks, Mr. Earle.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Sybil May, author of CandyBlog.net. Sybil, you've heard what Mr. Earle of the manufacturers, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, has said, saying there's no need to worry here. The products are going to be better. There's no concern about identity. What's your reaction to what you've heard?
Well, he made a couple of statements, and the biggest one, he said that there's no specific request to change the standards of chocolate identity. And while he may be correct that nobody actually said that they wanted to change it, it's in there. It says specifically in Appendix C that they can substitute vegetable fats that are specifically named, such as cacao fat, with other vegetable fats. And the statements from the Hershey Corporation and the Chocolate Manufacturers Association have indicated that they actually would like to take advantage of that clause in there to substitute cacao fat for safe and suitable vegetable fats to be named later.
And how much of a percentage change or substitution could they make?
The current definition of chocolate says that it needs to have 100% cacao fat and no additional vegetable fats. You can't add milk fat to it. So I'm guessing if it says safe and suitable and does not specify, it means that they can substitute all of it, all of the added cocoa butter that is in the chocolate. Obviously, there is some inherent in the cocoa liqueur or the cocoa solids that the chocolate is made from.
So what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that. They can make it right now. It's not a problem. They make it and they call it chocolate flavored or they call it chocolatey. They can do that, and they're more than welcome to. I don't want to buy it, and I don't want to be confused when I'm looking at something on a store shelf. And worse, I don't want to be confused in a situation where I can't look at the ingredients. If I go into an ice cream parlor and I ask for chocolate chip ice cream, I want those chocolate chips to be chocolate chips made with cocoa butter, not made with, hydrogenated palm oil.
All they say, Sybil May, is that they want a review. What is so harmful about a review of standards?
That's great. We're reviewing it right now, and as consumers, we've had the opportunity to say, because in their petition, they say that consumers have no expectations concerning the precise technical elements that their foods are produced. And what we're saying is that we do have expectations, and we're going to tell you what they are so you can work those into however this gets worked out in the next few years as they evaluate everything.
You are the author of CandyBlog.net. You're looking at chocolate here. You suggesting this is a much bigger issue than just chocolate?
I do think it's a bigger issue. I mean, chocolate is something I do eat every day, but I would hate to see things like mayonnaise and weird surfactants added to my pineapple juice. Or I just think that we need to just slow down. Technologies do benefit us, but there's a reason why we make the food the way we do, and it's great that we have this global economy and we have greater access to other ingredients, which may actually be more suitable in these situations. But I don't think that we need to make this huge, sweeping change all in one document. I think things can be evaluated a little bit slower and piecemeal, if you will.
Sybil May, the author of CandyBlog.net. Thanks for joining us, Sybil.
Thank you.
Before we go today, one of the world's top chefs puts a little sizzle into a down-home cooking class. You're listening to Here and Now. political fundraisers are so common these days in the first in the nation primary state of New Hampshire. But an event being organized by the Manchester, New Hampshire Republican Committee promises to be anything but ordinary. It's a machine gun shoot at which supporters will be able to fire Uzis, M16s, M60s, M50s, and other automatic weapons at a local firing range. Joining us on the line from New Hampshire is Jerry Thibodeau, chairman of the Manchester Republican Committee. And I bet you're excited about this August 5th event. And I must say, it's nothing if not novel. Now, I imagine some of your options here could have been the rubber chicken option, the barbecue. You could have had the golf tournaments, social nights. You could have had bingo, softball tournaments, auctions, even Tupperware parties. But this, how did you come up with this?
I'm yawning.
How did you come up with this?
It just came to me one day. We were having an executive board meeting, and we're trying to think of something novel. And I had just come back from the firing range, and I said, hey, what about a machine gun shoot? And all the eyes opened right up, the mouths dropped, smiles started coming across their faces. Why not?
So in the first-in-the-nation primary state, do you have the first-in-the-nation machine gun fundraiser?
Well, no. We have probably the first-in-the-nation political machine gun fundraiser. But machine gun shoots are all over the country all the time.
Right, but this is the first machine gun shoot political fundraiser. And how much are you charging?
$25 a head for the fundraiser, but then they have to pay for their ammo that they shoot.
And as anyone who shot a machine gun knows, that could be a considerable expense.
Well, for example, you know, you have some machine guns that, and this machine gun that I'm talking about is not going to be there, so don't take it out of context, okay? But there are some machine guns that can shoot up to 2,000 rounds per minute. If you put a price tag on a round of 75 cents, in a minute, you can blow off $1,500 and say, well, there's that.
So you think this is going to loosen people up and more particularly loosen the candidates up?
Well, it has loosened people up already. We're getting emailed by the hordes and globs that are just coming in. How do I get there? What time is the best time to be there? And not just for men, but from women also. Women are excited about this. I'm just becoming so exhilarated about this event.
You're getting exhilarated, but I imagine you may be ducking here and there because you're getting people firing at you. The head of the Manchester Democratic Party says the event's in poor taste. It's offensive, and he's even used it to criticize the mayor of Manchester because there's been a recent spike in violent crimes there.
They have to oppose us. You know that. You know, there's a few Republicans in this town that are saying, well, yeah, I support it, but, you know, maybe it's not a good idea. But they've never shot a machine gun in their life. They have no idea how exhilarating it can be. We're not firing at people. Actually, we're not even firing at pictures of people.
Mm.
What we're using is bowling pins. And they're suspended at different heights, so it would be more,
really?
Challenged to hit the
really?
Bowling pin. It's just something that just comes right over you. It's a sense of letting go. It's a sense of accomplishment. It's something happens in a matter of seconds that you turn around and you have this big smile on your face. You know, and for anyone who has never fired a machine gun, it's easy to criticize something when you don't know what you're talking about, when you've never experienced it. It's also easy to criticize something when you don't know the laws that apply to this and how stringent the laws are.
You're saying the risk here is far less than getting ptomaine poisoning from barbecue chickens.
You're absolutely right, and the risk is a lot less than driving your car down the road and getting into an accident.
Mm. You really wanted to get Rudy Giuliani, I understand.
I do. Have you ever seen this guy at a ball game? You see pictures of him?
Yes.
Tie on, he's got a suit coat on. I mean, this guy's gonna relax.
A clip or two with a machine gun, you might do the trick for him, do you think?
He'll put a smile on his face. Nobody's got the poke in the ribs to wake you up on this one.
Jerry Thibodeau is chairman of the Manchester Republican Committee, the first in the nation primary state, and now, come August 5th, the first in the nation machine gun political fundraiser. Thanks, Jerry.
Come on up. We'll be more than happy to have you.
Coming up, and duck cooking lessons from a master chef here and now. here and now. Despite Food Network and countless celebrity cookbooks thickening shelves like cornstarch would a pudding, would-be chefs still look for hands-on instruction. Enter Molly Stevens, a Vermont cooking teacher as well as award-winning cookbook writer. She teaches all over the world and has been honored by the International Association of Culinary Professionals. We wanted a taste of what she does, so we dropped in her class on the basics for a small group of folks from Maine. The event was hosted by Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst.
Welcome, everybody. I'm really glad you're here. I want to introduce Molly Stevens. Molly's going to introduce us to the menu tonight, and we'll get started.
Hi, I'm Molly Stevens. I am a cooking teacher from Vermont, and Kathy asked me to come here today. We cooked up this idea a couple months ago to do a hands-on class in this great kitchen. I have recipe handouts for everyone, and it's a hands-on class, so we're going to spend some time and go through each one of the dishes, and then we'll divide up into two teams, and we'll start cooking these dishes, and hopefully before we finish here tonight, we'll have dinner. One of the important rules when you're cooking is to read your recipes before you start cooking, and I like to read them twice.
Guys don't read the recipes.
I know. You got to read through them. Even though I'm going through this with you, I'm going to ask you to read your recipes. And the other thing is to get all your ingredients lined up and ready. So all your olives get pitted, your lemon gets zested, those sorts of things come together. There's some knives and things around, but we have more if you need them. I love teaching. Getting people to know how to do it on their own, passing on that knowledge, watching that spark when someone figures out how to do something. We call it the aha moment when you're teaching, when all of a sudden you're just doing something that you've always done, and the students will say, you know, ask a question about it or realize that that's going to save them time or that's why you do it, that type of thing. So there was just this energy about people coming in and realizing the difference between following a recipe and learning how to cook.
I'm curious about your students. It used to be that everybody learned to cook from their mother or their grandmother or their aunt, someone in the family that was always cooking, passing down recipes, family holidays. That seems to be very lost. We seem to have a generation that truly doesn't know how to cook. I wonder what your take is on the people that you teach all across the United States.
People ask me a lot, who are your students? And they're so varied, and their knowledge base is so varied. You'll have students who have this incredible fluency in ingredients. They know what chipotle and creme fraiche and all these things are, but they don't know how to hold a knife. And then you'll go to different parts of the country, and they still don't have the currency of those ingredients yet, too. So people are cooking, but they're learning, as you said, they didn't learn growing up. They're teaching themselves to cook. They're watching TV, Food Network. They're reading magazines. They're cooking on the weekends. And so there's this weird, it's almost like cooking in a vacuum because they're trying to find a context for it. And they don't necessarily have one. And so they're not sure, especially if you're learning off television, you don't know what it's supposed to taste like. And so it's a really interesting experience to then be face-to-face teaching where you can give them tastes.
What makes shiitake mushrooms different from regular mushrooms or like an ordinary mushroom that you would buy in the store?
They're a little bit more intense flavor, a little more mushroomy. It has this savory quality.
My name is Laura Smith, and I've got three kids. I work part-time as a fundraising consultant, and we're a busy, busy bunch.
And why did you want to come to this cooking class?
Well, to me, what's very frustrating about the way I cook now for my family is that it's always this afterthought and it's this mad dash to 5 o'clock. Like, what are we going to have tonight? I'm just at this point in my life where if I cook one more box of mac and cheese, I'm going to hurt somebody.
You guys are familiar with convection? It's a fan. Convection, the heat, there's a bunch of ways that heat can get transferred. There's conduction. My hand is cold. I put it on my face. It makes my face cold. That's conduction, direct contact, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then there's convection, which is hot air swirling around.
When is the best time to use convection?
When you're trying to roast, you're trying to dry something out, you're looking for crusty outside. Small things. If you do it for a big thing, like you put your chicken in a convection roast, if it's a big chicken, it might get done on the outside before it gets done on the inside. So it speeds up cooking.
My name is Ted Hebert. I'm a marketing executive for a software company in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
And I heard your wife hurt her hand and you have to start doing the cooking?
She did. She was jogging on one of the cliff walks down on York Beach and fell and wrenched out two of her fingers. So she's in constant physical therapy, and I got to learn this stuff a lot quicker than I have been.
So she's been the primary cook in the
house. Yeah.
And have you been taking over?
Bits and pieces as much as I can. If I could actually create some meals beforehand, the night before, and put them in the fridge, that would just, according to her, help her out a whole lot.
Right. So what's your goal for being here? What do you hope to come away with?
I hope to come away as a model husband who is thought of as helpful and conscientious, like all men.
Is that all?
If I could get half of that, I'd be doing great.
The sizzle, that sound you hear when it's a sizzle, that's the sound of the water leaving the food. So when you put a piece of meat in a pan to brown and it doesn't sizzle, it's not hot enough. It has to be hot enough to sizzle.
My name is Cheyenne Wright. I graduated from college 2 years ago. I live in a house with a very big kitchen, but I don't use it as much as I like. I had an apartment before I had a house for 4 years right after I graduated high school, and definitely did not use my kitchen enough. So I'm hoping to learn a few more tricks about the kitchen. I tend to make a lot of mashed potatoes, and I'm trying to reorganize my cooking repertoire, especially because I now cook for my boyfriend and my roommate, and we all cook.
Well, you're doing very well with the grated carrots.
Well, I feel like I'm an accomplished grater. I've been grating since a very young age, and
what do you hope to get out of this?
I think that learning the different tricks of how you can make a four-course meal out of something as easy as chicken and carrot salad, I mean, that's pretty cool in itself. But I think also getting back to the social aspect, everyone being in the kitchen together and working together is really important and really fun.
See, it's seizing up. The caramel's seizing up. But now we're going to redissolve it in the cream. See that? See, it's seizing up. A big hunk of caramel in the middle there. But now we're just going to redissolve it and keep going. Look at that. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Okay, here we are. We're sitting at the table. We have these beautiful carrot and goat cheese salads in front of us, and I would like to make a toast. Something I didn't tell you guys earlier, because I didn't want her to be shy and I wanted her to earn it, is that Molly Stevens was named the Cooking Teacher of the Year last year by the IACP, meaning like she's the best cooking teacher anywhere. So we've had a really lucky, wonderful day, and thank you so much, Molly. Cheers.
Wow. Cheers.
Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Guntz, toasting chef and cooking teacher Molly Stevens. We also heard from Laura Smith, Ted Hebert, and Cheyenne Wright. For more, go to our website, here-now.org, and while you're there, download a podcast of our show. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hati, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Shugartz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Chris Cuff, Ben Singer, Emily Mahoney, and Emily Reddy. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. And the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. Robin Young returns on Monday. I'm David Boeri. Have a great weekend, eat well, and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.